She's a widow, I said. She rents rooms. What is her educational background? She's had very little. More or less like the old couple that was evicted. Somewhat, but better able to take care of herself. She's tough, I said with a laugh. Does she ask a lot of questions? Are you friendly with her? Well, she's been very nice to me, I said. She allowed me to stay on after I was unable to pay my rent. He shook his head. No. What is it? I said. It is best that you move, he said. We'll find you a place further downtown so that you'll be within easy call. But I have no money, and she's entirely trustworthy. That will be taken care of, he said, waving his hand. You must realize immediately that much of our work is opposed. Our discipline demands, therefore, that we talk to no one, and that we avoid situations in which information might be given away unwittingly. So, you must put aside your past. Do you have a family?
Yes.
Are you in touch with them?
Of course. I write home now and then,
I said, beginning to resent his method of questioning. His voice had become cold, searching. Then it's best that you cease for a while, he said. Anyway, you'll be too busy. Here. He fished into his vest pocket for something and got suddenly to his feet.
What is it?
Someone asked. Nothing. Excuse me, he said, rolling to the door and beckoning. In a moment, I saw the woman appear. Emma, the slip of paper I gave you. Give it to the new brother, he said as he stepped inside and closed the door.
Oh, so it's you, she said with a meaningful smile.
I watched her reach into the bosom of her taffeta hostess gown and remove a white envelope. This is your new identity, Brother Jack said. Open it. Inside, I found a name written on a slip of paper. That is your new name, Brother Jack said. Start thinking of yourself by that name from this moment. Get it down so that even if you are called in the middle of the night, you will respond. Very soon you shall be known by it all over the country. You are to answer to no other. Understand?
I'll try, I said.
Don't forget his living quarters, the tall man said.
No, Brother Jack said with a frown. Emma, please, some funds.
How much, Jack? She said.
He turned to me. Do you owe much rent?
Too much, I said.
Make it 300, Emma, he said.
Never mind, he said as I showed my surprise at the sum. This will pay your debts and buy you clothing.
Call me in the morning and I'll have selected your living quarters. For a start, your salary will be $60 a week.
$60 a week?
Phew. There was nothing I could say. The woman had crossed the room to the desk and returned with the money, placing it in my hand.
You'd better put it away, she said expansively.
Well, brothers, I believe that's all, he said. Emma, how about a drink?
Of course, she said, going to a cabinet and removing a decanter and a set of glasses in which she poured about an inch of clear liquid. Here you are, brothers, she said.
Taking his, Brother Jack raised it to his nose, inhaling deeply. To the brotherhood of man, to history, and to change, he said, touching my glass. To history, we all said.
The stuff burned, causing me to lower my head to hide the tears that popped from my eyes.
Ah, someone said with deep satisfaction.
Come along, Emma said. Let's join the others.
Now for some pleasure, Brother Jack said, and remember your new identity.
I wanted to think, but they gave me no time. I was swept into the large room and introduced by my new name. Everyone smiled and seemed eager to meet me, as though they all knew the role I was to play. Old grasped me warmly by the hand.
What is your opinion of the state of women's rights, brother?
I was asked by a plain woman in a large black velvet tam.
But before I could open my mouth, Brother Jack had pushed me along to a group of men, one of whom seemed to know all about the eviction. Nearby, a group around the piano was singing folk songs with more volume than melody. We moved from group to group,
Brother Jack very authoritative, the others always respectful. He must be a powerful man, I thought, not a clown at all. But to hell with this Booker T. Washington business. I would do the work, but I would be no one except myself. Whoever I was. I would pattern my life on that of the founder. They might think I was acting like Booker T. Washington. Well, let them. But what I thought of myself, I would keep to myself. Yes, and I'd have to hide the fact that I had actually been afraid when I made my speech. Suddenly I felt laughter bubbling inside me. I'd have to catch up with this science of history business. We had come to stand near the piano now, where an intense young man questioned me about various leaders of the Harlem community. I knew them only by name, but pretended that I knew them all. Good, he said, good. We have to work with all these forces during the coming period. Yes, you're quite right, I said, giving my glass a tinkling twirl. A short, broad man saw me and waved the others to a halt.
Say, brother, he called. Hold the music, boys. Hold it.
Yes, brother, I said.
You're just who we need. We've been looking for you.
Oh, I said.
How about a spiritual brother or one of those real good old Negro work songs like this? I went to Atlanta, never been there before, he sang, his arms held out from his body like a penguin's wings, glass in one hand, cigar in the other. White man sleep in a feather bed, nigger sleep on the floor. How about it, brother?
The brother does not sing, Brother Jack roared staccato.
Nonsense! All colored people sang.
This is an outrageous example of unconscious racial chauvinism, Jack said.
Nonsense! I like this singing,
the broad man said doggedly. The brother does not sing, Brother Jack cried, his face turning a deep purple. The broad man regarded him stubbornly.
Why don't you let him say whether he can sing or not? Come on, brother. Get out.
Go down, Moses, he bellowed in a ragged baritone, putting down his cigar and snapping his fingers.
Way down in Egypt's land, tell that old pharaoh to let my colored folks sing. I'm for the rights of the colored brother to sing.
He shouted belligerently. Brother Jack looked as if he would choke. He raised his hand, signaling. I saw two men shoot from across the room and lead the short man roughly away. Brother Jack followed them as they disappeared beyond the door, leaving an enormous silence. For a moment I stood there, my eyes riveted upon the door. Then I turned, the glass hot in my hand, my face feeling as though it would explode. Why was everyone staring at me, as though I were responsible? Why the hell were they staring at me? Suddenly, I yelled,
What's the matter with you? Haven't you ever seen a drunk?
When somewhere off the foyer, the broad man's voice staggered drunkenly to us.
St. Louis, mammy, with her diamond ring,
and was clipped off by a slamming door, leaving a room full of bewildered faces. And suddenly, I was laughing hysterically.
He hit me in the face, I wheezed. He hit me in the face with a yard of chitterlings.
Bending double, roaring, the whole room seeming to dance up and down with each rapid eruption of laughter.
He threw a hog maw, I cried,
but no one seemed to understand. My eyes filled, I could barely see.
He's high as a Georgia pine, I laughed,
turning to the group nearest me.
He's absolutely drunk. Off music.
Yes, sure, a man said nervously. Three sheets to the wind. Getting my breath now, and discovering that the silent tension of the others was ebbing into a ripple of laughter that sounded throughout the room, growing swiftly to a roar, a laugh of all dimensions, intensities, and intonations. Everyone was joining in. The room fairly bounced. And did you see Brother Jack's face? A man shouted, shaking his head. It was murder. Go down, Moses. I tell you, it was murder. Across the room, they were pounding someone on the back to keep him from choking. Handkerchiefs appeared. There was much honking of noses, wiping of eyes. A glass crashed to the floor. A chair was overturned. I fought against the painful laughter, and as I calmed, I saw them looking at me with a sort of embarrassed gratitude. It was sobering, and yet they seemed bent upon pretending that nothing unusual had happened. They smiled. Several seemed about to come over and pound my back, shake my hand. It was as though I had told them something which they wished very much to hear, had rendered them an important service which I couldn't understand. But there it was, working in their faces. My stomach ached. I wanted to leave to get their eyes off me. Then a thin little woman came over and grasped my hand. "I'm so sorry that this had to happen," she said in a slow Yankee voice. "Really and truly sorry. Some of our brothers aren't so highly developed, you know, although they mean very well. You must allow me to apologize for him." "Oh, he was only tipsy," I said, looking into her thin New England face. "Yes, I know, and revealingly so. I would never ask our colored brothers to sing, even though I love to hear them, because I know that it would be a very backward thing. You are here to fight along with us, not to entertain. I think you understand me, don't you, brother?" I gave her a silent smile. "Of course you do. I must go now. Goodbye," she said, extending her little white-gloved hand and leaving. I was puzzled. Just what did she mean? Was it that she understood that we resented having others think that we were all entertainers and natural singers? But now, after the mutual laughter, something disturbed me. Shouldn't there be some way for us to be asked to sing? Shouldn't the short man have the right to make a mistake without his motives being considered consciously or unconsciously malicious? After all, he was singing, or trying to. What if I asked him to sing? I watched the little woman, dressed in black like a missionary, winding her way through the crowd. What on earth was she doing here? What part did she play? Well, whatever she meant. She's nice, and I like her. Just then, Emma came up and challenged me to dance, and I led her toward the floor as the piano played, thinking of the vet's prediction and drawing her to me as though I danced with such as her every evening. For having committed myself, I felt that I could never allow myself to show surprise or upset, even when confronted with situations furthest from my experience. Otherwise, I might be considered undependable or unworthy. I felt that somehow they expected me to perform even those tasks for which nothing in my experience, except perhaps my imagination, had prepared me. Still, it was nothing new. White folks seemed always to expect you to know those things which they'd done everything they could think of to prevent you from knowing. The thing to do was to be prepared, as my grandfather had been when it was demanded that he quote the entire United States Constitution as a test of his fitness to vote. He had confounded them all by passing the test, although they still refused him the ballot. Anyway, these were different. It was close to 5 a.m., many dances and many bourbons later, when I reached Mary's. Somehow, I felt surprised that the room was still the same, except that Mary had changed the bed linen.
Good old Mary. I felt sadly sobered. And as I undressed, I saw my outworn clothes and realized that I'd have to shed them. Certainly it was time. Even my hat would go. Its green was sun-faded and brown like a leaf struck by the winter's snows. I would require a new one for my new name. A black, broad-brimmed one. Perhaps a Homburg. Humbug, I laughed. Well, I could leave packing for tomorrow. I had very little, which was perhaps all to the good. I would travel light, far, and fast. They were fast people, all right. What a vast difference between Mary and those for whom I was leaving her. And why should it be this way? That the very job which might make it possible for me to do some of the things which she expected of me required that I leave her. What kind of room would Brother Jack select for me, and why wasn't I left to select my own? It didn't seem right that in order to become a Harlem leader, I should live elsewhere. Yet nothing seemed right, and I would have to rely upon their judgment. They seemed expert in such matters, but how far could I trust them? And in what way were they different from the trustees? Whatever, I was committed. I'd learn in the process of working with them, I thought, remembering the money. The bills were crisp and fresh, and I tried to imagine Mary's surprise when I paid her all my back rent and board. She'd think that I was kidding. But money could never repay her generosity. She would never understand my wanting to move so quickly after getting a job. And if I had any kind of success at all, it would seem the height of ingratitude. How would I face her? She had asked for nothing in return, or hardly anything except that I make something of myself that she called a race leader. I shivered in the cold. Telling her that I was moving would be a hard proposition. I didn't like to think of it. But one couldn't be sentimental. As Brother Jack had said, history makes harsh demands of us all. But they were demands that had to be met if men were to be the masters and not the victims of their times. Did I believe that? Perhaps I had already begun to pay. Besides, I might as well admit right now, I thought, that there are many things about people like Mary that I dislike. For one thing, they seldom know where their personalities end and yours begins. They usually think in terms of we, while I have always tended to think in terms of me. And that has caused some friction, even with my own family. Brother Jack and the others talked in terms of we. But it was a different, bigger we. Well, I had a new name. And new problems. I had best leave the old behind. Perhaps it would be best not to see Mary at all, just place the money in an envelope and leave it on the kitchen table where she'd be sure to find it. It would be better that way, I thought drowsily. Then there'd be no need to stand before her and stumble over emotions and words that were at best all snarled up and undifferentiated. One thing about the people at the Thonian, they all seemed able to say just what they felt and meant in hard, clear terms. That, too, I'd have to learn. I stretched out beneath the covers, hearing the springs groan beneath me. The room was cold. I listened to the night sounds of the house. The clock ticked with empty urgency, as though trying to catch up with the time. In the street, a siren howled. Then I was awake and not awake, sitting bolt upright in bed and trying to peer through the sick gray light as I sought the meaning of the brash nerve-jangling sound. Pushing the blanket aside, I clasped my hands to my ears. Someone was pounding the steam line, and I stared helplessly For what seemed minutes, my ears throbbed, my side began itching violently, and I tore open my pajamas to scratch, and suddenly the pain seemed to leap from my ears to my side, and I saw gray marks appearing where the old skin was flaking away beneath my digging nails. And as I watched, I saw thin lines of blood well up in the scratches, bringing pain and joining time and place again. And I thought, the room has lost its heat on my last day at Mary's, and suddenly I was sick at heart. The clock, its alarm lost in the larger sound, said 7:30, and I got out of bed. I'd have to hurry. There was shopping to do before I called Brother Jack for my instruction, and I had to get the money to Mary. Why didn't they stop that noise? I reached for my shoes, flinching as the knocking seemed to sound an inch above my head. Why don't they stop, I thought. And why do I feel so let down? The bourbon? My nerves going bad? Suddenly, I was across the room in a bound, pounding the pipe furiously with my shoe heels. Stop it, you ignorant fool! My head was splitting. Beside myself, I struck pieces of silver from the pipe, exposing the black and rusted iron. He was using a piece of metal now, his blows ringing with a ragged edge. If only I knew who it was, I thought, looking for something heavy with which to strike back. If only I knew. Then, near the door, I saw something which I'd never noticed there before. The cast-iron figure of a very black, red-lipped, and wide-mouthed Negro, whose white eyes stared up at me from the floor, his face an enormous grin, his single, large, black hand held palm up before his chest. It was a bank, a piece of early Americana, the kind of bank which, if a coin is placed in the hand and a lever pressed upon the back, will raise its arm and flip the coin into the grinning mouth. For a second, I stopped, feeling hate charging within me, then dashed over and grabbed it. Suddenly, as enraged by the tolerance or lack of discrimination or whatever that allowed Mary to keep such a self-mocking image around as by the knocking. In my hand, its expression seemed more of a strangulation than a grin. It was choking, filled to the throat with coins. How the hell did it get here, I wondered, dashing over and striking the pipe a blow with the kinky iron head. Shut up, I screamed, which seemed only to enrage the hidden knocker. The din was deafening. Tenants up and down the entire line of apartments joined in. I hammered back with the iron naps, seeing the silver fly striking like driven sand against my face. The pipe fairly hummed with the blows. Windows were going up. Voices yelled obscenities down the air shaft. Who started all this, I wondered? Who's responsible? Why don't you act like responsible people living in the 20th century? I yelled, aiming a blow at the pipe. Get rid of your cotton patch ways. Act civilized! Then came a crash of sound, and I felt the iron head crumble and fly apart in my hand. Coins flew over the room like crickets, ringing, rattling against the floor, rolling. I stopped dead.
"Just listen to 'em! Just listen to 'em!" Mary called from the hall. "Enough noise to wake the dead. They know when the heat don't come up that the soup is drunk or done walked off the job looking for his woman or something. Why don't folks act according to what they know?"
She was at my door now, knocking, stroke for stroke, with the blows landing on the pipe, calling,
"Son, ain't some of that knocking coming from in there?"
I turned from side to side in indecision, looking at the pieces of broken head, the small coins of all denominations that were scattered about.
"You hear me, boy?"
she called.
"What is it?"
I called, dropping to the floor and reaching frantically for the broken pieces, thinking, if she opens the door, I'm lost.
"I said, is any of that racket coming from in there?"
Yes, it is, Mary," I called, but I'm all right. I'm already awake."
I saw the knob move and froze, hearing,
"Sounded to me like a heap of it was coming from in there. You got your clothes on?"
No," I cried. "I'm just dressing. I'll have them on in a minute." Come on out to the kitchen, she said. It's warm out there, and there's some hot water on the stove to wash your face in, and some coffee. Lord, just listen at the racket.
I stood as though frozen until she moved away from the door. I'd have to hurry. I kneeled, picking up a piece of the bank, a part of the red-shirted chest reading the legend, Feed Me, in a curve of white iron letters, like the team name on an athlete's shirt. The figure had gone to pieces like a grenade, scattering jagged fragments of painted iron among the coins. I looked at my hand. A small trickle of blood showed. I wiped it away, thinking, I'll have to hide this mess. I can't take her this and the news that I'm moving at the same time. Taking a newspaper from the chair, I folded it stiffly and swept the coins and broken metal into a pile. Where would I hide it, I wondered, looking with profound distaste at the Iron King's the dull red of a piece of grinning lip. Why, I thought with anguish, would Mary have something like this around anyway? Just why? I looked under the bed. It was dustless there. No place to hide anything. She was too good a housekeeper. Besides, what of the coins? Hell! Maybe the thing was left by the former roomer. Ah! Anyway, whosoever it was, it had to be hidden. There was the closet, but she'd find it there, too. After I was gone a few days, she'd clean out my things, and there it'd be. The knocking had gone beyond mere protest over heedlessness now. It had fallen into a ragged rumba rhythm. Knock, 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 vibrating the very floor. Just a few minutes more, you bastards, I said out loud, and I'll be gone. No respect for the individual. Why don't you think about those who might wish to sleep? What if someone is near a nervous breakdown? But there was still the package. There was nothing to do but get rid of it along the way downtown. Making a tight bundle, I placed it in my overcoat pocket. I'd simply have to give Mary enough money to cover the coins. I'd give her as much as I could spare, half of what I had, if necessary. That should make up for some of it. She should appreciate that. And now I realized with a feeling of dread that I had to meet her face to face. There was no way out. Why can't I just tell her that I'm leaving and pay her and go off? She was a landlady. I was a tenant. Ugh, no. There was more to it, and I wasn't hard enough, scientific enough, even to tell her that I was leaving. I'll tell her I have a job, anything, but it has to be now. She was sitting at the table drinking coffee when I went in, the kettle hissing away on the stove, sending up jets of steam. Gee, but you slow this morning, she said. Take some of that water in the kettle and go wash your face. Though sleepy as you look, maybe you ought to just use cold water. This'll do, I said flatly, feeling the steam drifting upon my face, growing swiftly damp and cold. The clock above the stove was slower than mine. In the bathroom, I put in the plug and poured some of the hot water and cooled it from the spigot. I kept the tear-warm water upon my face a long time, then dried and returned to the kitchen. Run it full again, she said when I returned. How you feel? So-so, I said. She sat with her elbows upon the enameled tabletop, her cup held in both hands, one work-worn little finger delicately curved. I went to the sink and turned the spigot, feeling the cold rush of water upon my hand, thinking of what I had to do.
That's enough there, boy, Mary said, startling me. Wake up!
I guess I'm not all here, I said. My mind was wandering.
Well, call her back and come get you some coffee. Soon as I've had mine, I'll see what kind of breakfast I can whip together. I guess after last night, you can eat this morning. You didn't come back for supper.
I'm sorry, I said. Coffee will be enough for me.
Boy, you better start eating again, she warned,
pouring me a full cup of coffee. I took the cup and sipped it, black. It was bitter. She glanced from me to the sugar bowl and back again, but remained silent, then swirled her cup, looking into it.
Guess I got to get some better filters, she mused. These I got just lets through the grounds along with the coffee, the good with the bad. I don't know, though. Even with the best filters, you have to find a ground or two at the bottom of the old cup.
I blew upon the steaming liquid, avoiding Mary's eyes. The knocking was becoming unbearable again. I'd have to get away. I looked at the hot metallic surface of the coffee, noticing an oily, opalescent swirl. Look, Mary, I said, plunging in, I want to talk to you about something.
Now see here, boy, she said gruffly, I don't want you worrying me about your rent this morning. I'm not worried, because when you get it, I know you'll pay me. Meanwhile, you forget it. Nobody in this house is going to starve. You having any luck lining up a job?
No. I mean, not exactly, I stammered, seizing the opportunity. But I've got an appointment to see about one this morning. Her face brightened.
Oh, that's fine. You'll get something yet. I know it.
But about my debt, I began again.
Don't worry about it. How about some hotcakes?
She asked, rising and going to look into the cabinet.
They'll stick with you in this cold weather.
I won't have time, I said, but I've got something for you.
Oh, what's that?
She said, her voice coming muffled as she peered inside the cabinet. Here, I said hurriedly, reaching into my pocket for the money.
What? Let me see if I've got some syrup.
But look, I said eagerly, removing a $100 bill.
Must be on a higher shelf, she said,
her back still turned. I sighed as she dragged a stepladder from beside the cabinet and mounted it, holding on to the doors and peering upon an upper shelf. I'd never get it said.
But I'm trying to give you something, I said. Why don't you quit bothering me, boy? You trying to give me what?
She said, looking over her shoulder. I held up the bill.
This,
I said. She craned her head around.
Boy, what you got there? It's money.
Money?
Good God, boy!
She said, almost losing her balance as she turned completely around.
Where'd you get all that much money? You've been playing the numbers.
That's it. My number came up, I said thankfully, thinking, what'll I say if she asks me what the number was? I didn't know. I never played.
But how come you didn't tell me? I'd have at least put a nickel on it.
I didn't think it would do anything, I said.
Well, I declare.
And I bet it was your first time, too.
It was. See there? I knowed you was the lucky one. Here I've been playing for years, and the first drop of the bucket you hits for that kind of money. I'm so glad for you, son. I really am. But I don't want your money. Wait till you get a job.
But I'm not giving you all of it, I said hastily. This is just on account.
But that's $100 bill. I'd take that and try to change it, and the white folks would want to know my whole life's history, she snorted. They want to know where I was born, where I work, where I've been for the last 6 months. And when I tell them, they still gonna think I stole it. Ain't you got nothing smaller?
That's the smallest.
Take it, I pleaded. I'll have enough left.
She looked at me shrewdly.
You show.
It's the truth, I said.
Well, I declare. Let me get down from up here before I fall and break my neck, son,
she said, coming down off the ladder.
I sure do appreciate it. But I tell you, I'm just gonna keep part of it for myself, and the rest I'm going to save for you. You get hard up, you just come to Mary.
I think I'll be all right now, I said, watching her fold the money carefully, placing it in the leather bag that always hung on the back of her chair.
I'm really glad, because now I can take care of that bill they've been bothering me about. It'll do me so much good to go in there and plop down some money and tell them folks to quit bothering me. Son, I believe your luck done changed. You dream that number?
I glanced at her eager face.
Yes,
I said, but it was a mixed-up dream.
What was the figure? Jesus, what's this? She cried,
getting up and pointing at the linoleum near the steam line. I saw a small drove of roaches trooping frantically down the steam line from the floor above, plummeting to the floor as the vibration of the pipe shook them off.
Get the broom, Mary yelled. Out of the closet, there!
Stepping around the chair, I snatched the broom and joined her, splattering and scattering roaches with both broom and feet, hearing the pop and snap as I brought the pressure down upon them vehemently.
The filthy, stinking things, Mary cried. Get that one under the table. Yon he goes. Don't let him get away, the nasty rascal.
I swung the broom, battering and sweeping the squashed insects into piles. Breathing excitedly, Mary got the dustpan and handed it to me.
Some folks just live in filth, she said disgustedly. Just let a little knocking start and here it comes, crawling out. All you have to do is shake things up a bit.
I looked at the damp spots on the linoleum, then shakily replaced the pan and broom and started out of the room.
Aren't you going to eat no breakfast? She said. Soon as I wipe up this mess, I'm going to start.
I don't have time, I said, my hand on the knob. My appointment is early, and I have a few things to do beforehand.
Then you better stop and have you something hot as soon as you can. Don't do to go around in this cold weather without something in your belly. And don't think you're going to start eating out just because you got some money.
I don't. I'll take care of it, I said to her back as she washed her hands.
Well, good luck, son, she called. You really give me a pleasant surprise this morning. And if that's a lie, I hope something big'll bite me.
She laughed gaily, and I went down the hall to my room and closed the door. Pulling on my overcoat, I got down my prized briefcase from the closet. It was still as new as the night of the Battle Royal, and sag now as I placed the smashed bank and coins inside and locked the flap. Then I closed the closet door and left. The knocking didn't bother me so much now. Mary was singing something sad and serene as I went down the hall, and still singing as I opened the door and stepped into the outside hall. Then I remembered, and there beneath the dim hall light, I took the faintly perfumed paper from my wallet and carefully unfolded it. A tremor passed over me. The hall was cold. Then it was gone, and I squinted and took a long, hard look at my new Brotherhood name. The night's snowfall was already being churned to muck by the passing cars, and it was warmer. Joining the pedestrians along the walk, I could feel the briefcase swinging against my leg from the weight of the package, and I determined to get rid of the coins and broken iron at the first ash can. I needed nothing like this to remind me of my last morning at Mary's. I made for a row of crushed garbage cans lined before a row of old private houses, coming alongside and tossing the package casually into one of them and moving on, only to hear a door open behind me and a voice ring out,
"Oh, no, you don't. Oh, no, you don't. Just come right back here and get it."
Turning, I saw a little woman standing on the stoop with a green coat covering her head and shoulders, its sleeves hanging limp like extra atrophied arms.
"I mean you," she called. "Come on back and get your trash. And don't ever put your trash in my can again."
She was a short, yellow woman with a pince-nez on a chain, her hair pinned up in knots.
"We keep our place clean and respectable, and we don't want you field niggas coming up from the south and ruining things," she shouted with blazing hate.
People were stopping to look. A super from a building down the block came out and stood in the middle of the walk, pounding his fist against his palm with a dry smacking sound. I hesitated, embarrassed and annoyed. Was this woman crazy?
"I mean it. Yes, you. I'm talking to you. You just take it right out. Rosalie," she called to someone inside the house, "call the police, Rosalie."
I can't afford that, I thought, and walked back to the can.
"What does it matter, miss?" I called up to her. "When the collectors come, garbage is garbage. I just didn't want to throw it into the street. I didn't know that some kinds of garbage were better than others." "Never mind your impertinence," she said. "I'm sick and tired of having you southern Negroes mess up things for the rest of us."
"All right," I said, "I'll get it out." And reached into the half-filled can, feeling for the package, as the fumes of rotting swill entered my nostrils. It felt unhealthy to my hand, and the heavy package had sunk far down. Cursing, I pushed back my sleeve with my clean hand and probed until I found it. Then I wiped off my arm with a handkerchief and started away, aware of the people who paused to grin at me.
"It serves you right,"
the little woman called from the stoop, and I turned and started upward.
"That's enough out of you,
you piece of yellow, gaunt waste.
unless you still want to call the police." My voice had taken on a new shrill pitch. "I've done what you wanted me to do. Another word, and I'll do what I want to do." She looked at me with widening eyes. "I believe you would," she said, opening the door. "I believe you would." "I not only would, I'd love it," I said. "I can see that you are no gentleman," she called, slamming the door. At the next row of cans, I wiped off my wrist and hands with a piece of newspaper, then wrapped the rest around the package. Next time, I'd throw it into the street. 2 blocks further along, my anger had ebbed, but I felt strangely lonely. Even the people who stood around me at the intersection seemed isolated, each lost in his own thoughts. And now, just as the lights changed, I let the package fall into the trampled snow and hurried across, thinking, "There, it's done." I had covered 2 blocks when someone called behind me.
"Say, buddy! Hey there, you, mister! Wait a second."
And I could hear the hurried crunching of the footsteps upon the snow. Then he was beside me, a squat man in worn clothes, the strands of his breath showing white in the cold as he smiled at me, panting.
"You was moving so fast I thought I wasn't going to be able to stop you," he said. "Didn't you lose something back there apiece?"
"Oh, hell. A friend in need," I thought, deciding to deny it.
"Lose something?"
I said.
"Why, no." "You sure?"
he said, frowning. "Yes," I said, seeing his forehead wrinkle with uncertainty, a hot charge of fear leaping to his eyes as he searched my face.
"But I seen you." "Say, buddy," he said, looking swiftly back up the street, "what you trying to do?"
"Do? What do you mean?"
"I mean, talking about you didn't lose nothing. You working a con game or something?"
He backed away, looking hurriedly at the pedestrians back up the street from where he'd come. "What on earth are you talking about now?" I said. "I tell you, I didn't lose anything."
"Man, don't tell me. I seen you. What the hell you mean?"
he said furtively, removing the package from his pocket.
"This here feels like money or a gun or something, and I know damn well I seen you drop it."
"Oh, that," I said. "That isn't anything. I thought you..."
"That's right. Oh, so you remembers now, don't you? I think I'm doing you a favor and you play me for a fool. You some kind of confidence man or dope peddler or something? You trying to work one of those pigeon drops on me?"
"Pigeon drop," I said. "You're making a mistake."
"Mistake? Hell, take this damn stuff,"
he said, thrusting the package in my hands as though it were a bomb with a lighted fuse.
"I got a family, man. I try to do you a favor and here you trying to get me into trouble. You running from a detective or somebody?"
"Wait a minute," I said. "You're letting your imagination run away. This is nothing but garbage."
"Don't try to hand me that simple-minded crap," he wheezed. "I know what kind of garbage it is. You young New York Negroes is a blip. I swear you is. I hope they catch you and put your ass under the jail."
He shot away as though I had smallpox. I looked at the package. "He thinks it's a gun or stolen goods," I thought, watching him go. A few steps farther along, I was about to toss it boldly into the street when, upon looking back, I saw him joined by another man now, gesturing toward me indignantly. I hurried away. "Give him time and the fool will call a policeman." I dropped the package back into the briefcase. I'd wait until I got downtown. On the subway, people around me were reading their morning papers, pressing forward their unpleasant faces. I rode with my eyes shut, trying to make my mind blank to thoughts of Mary. Then turning, I saw the item, "Violent protest over Harlem eviction," just as the man lowered his paper and moved out of the breaking doors. I could hardly wait until I reached 42nd Street, where I found the story carried on the front page of a tabloid, and I read it eagerly. I was referred to only as an unknown rabble-rouser who had disappeared in the excitement, but that it referred to me was unmistakable. It had lasted for 2 hours, the crowd refusing to vacate the premises. I entered the clothing store with a new sense of self-importance. I selected a more expensive suit than I'd intended,
and while it was being altered, I picked up a hat, shirts, shoes, underwear, and socks, then hurried to call Brother Jack, who snapped his orders like a general. I was to go to a number on the Upper East Side, where I'd find a room, and I was to read over some of the Brotherhood's literature, which had been left there for me, with the idea of my making a speech at a Harlem rally to be held that evening. The address was that of an undistinguished building in a mixed Spanish-Irish neighborhood, and there were boys throwing snowballs across the street when I rang the super's bell. The door was opened by a small, pleasant-faced woman who smiled. "Good morning, brother," she said. "The apartment is all ready for you." "He said you'd come about this time, and I've just this minute come down. My, just look at that snow." I followed her up the three flights of stairs, wondering what on earth I'd do with a whole apartment. "This is it," she said, removing a chain of keys from her pocket and opening a door at the front of the hall. I went into a small, comfortably furnished room that was bright with the winter sun. "This is the living room," she said proudly, "and over here is your bedroom." It was much larger than I needed, with a chest of drawers, two upholstered chairs, two closets, a bookshelf, and a desk on which was stacked the literature to which he'd referred. A bathroom lay off the bedroom, and there was a small kitchen. "I hope you like it, brother," she said as she left. "If there's anything you need, please ring my bell." The apartment was clean and neat, and I liked it, especially the bathroom with its tub and shower. And as quickly as I could, I drew a bath and soaked myself. Then, feeling clean and exhilarated, I went out to puzzle over the Brotherhood books and pamphlets. My briefcase with the broken image lay on the table. I would get rid of the package later. Right now, I had to think about tonight's rally. At 7:30, Brother Jack and some of the others picked me up, and we shot up to Harlem in a taxi. As before, no one spoke a word. There was only the sound made by a man in the corner who drew noisily on a pipeful of rum-flavored tobacco, causing it to glow on and off, a red disc in the dark. I rode with mounting nervousness. The taxi seemed unnaturally warm. We got out in a side street and went down a narrow alley in the dark to the rear of the huge, barn-like building. Other members had already arrived. "Ah, here we are," Brother Jack said, leading the way through a dark rear door to a dressing room lighted by naked, low-hanging bulbs. A small room with wooden benches and a row of steel lockers with a network of names scratched on the doors. It had a football locker smell of ancient sweat, iodine, blood, and rubbing alcohol, and I felt a welling up of memories. "We remain here until the building fills," Brother Jack said. "Then we make our appearances, just at the height of their impatience." He gave me a grin. "Meanwhile, you think about what you'll say. Did you look over the material?" "All day," I said. "Good. I suggest, however, that you listen carefully to the rest of us. We'll all precede you so that you can get the pointers for your remarks. You'll be last." I nodded, seeing him take two of the other men by the arm and retreat to a corner. I was alone. The others were studying their notes, talking. I went across the room to a torn photograph tacked to the faded wall. It was a shot, in fighting stance, of a former prize fight champion, a popular fighter who had lost his sight in the ring. It must have been right here in this arena, I thought. That had been years ago. The photograph was that of a man so dark and battered that he might have been any nationality, big and loose-muscled. He looked like a good man. I remembered my father's story of how he had been beaten blind in a crooked fight, of the scandal that had been suppressed, and how the fighter had died in a home for the blind. Who would have thought I'd ever come here? How things were twisted around. I felt strangely sad and went and slouched on a bench. The others talked on, their voices low. I watched them with a sudden resentment. Why did I have to come last? What if they bored the audience to death before I came on? I'd probably be shouted down before I could get started. But perhaps not, I thought, jabbing my suspicions away. Perhaps I could make an effect through the sheer contrast between my approach and theirs. Maybe that was the strategy. Anyway, I had to trust them. I had to. Still, a nervousness clung to me. I felt out of place. From beyond the door, I could hear a distant scrape of chairs, a murmur of voices. Little worries whirled up within me. That I might forget my new name. That I might be recognized from the audience. I bent forward, suddenly conscious of my legs and my new blue trousers. But how do you know they're your legs? What's your name? I thought, making a sad joke with myself. It was absurd, but it relieved my nervousness. For it was as though I were looking at my own legs for the first time, independent objects that could, of their own volition, lead me to safety or danger. I stared at the dusty floor. Then it was as though I stood simultaneously at opposite ends of a tunnel. I seemed to view myself from the distance of the campus while yet sitting there on a bench in the old arena, dressed in a new blue suit, sitting across the room from a group of intense men who talked among themselves in hushed, edgy voices, while yet in the distance I could hear the clatter of chairs, more voices, a cough. I seemed aware of it all from a point deep within me. Yet there was a disturbing vagueness about what I saw, a disturbing, unformed quality, as when you see yourself in a photo exposed during adolescence, the expression empty, the grin without character, the ears too big, the pimples, courage bumps, too many and too well defined. This was a new phase, I realized, a new beginning, and I would have to take that part of myself that looked on with remote eyes and keep it always at the distance of the campus, the hospital machine, the battle royal, all now far behind. Perhaps the part of me that observed listlessly but saw all, missing nothing, was still the malicious, arguing part, the dissenting voice, my grandfather part, the cynical, disbelieving part, the traitor self that always threatened internal discord. Whatever it was, I knew that I'd have to keep it pressed down. I had to. For if I were successful tonight, I'd be on the road to something big. No more flying apart at the seams. No more remembering forgotten pains. No, I thought, shifting my body. They're the same legs on which I've come so far from home. And yet, they were somehow new. The new suit imparted a newness to me. It was the clothes and the new name and the circumstances. It was a newness too subtle to put into thought, but there it was. I was becoming someone else. I sensed vaguely and with a flash of panic that the moment I walked out upon the platform and opened my mouth, I'd be someone else. Not just a nobody with a manufactured name which might have belonged to anyone or to no one, but another personality. Few people knew me now, but after tonight, how was it? Perhaps simply to be known, to be looked upon by so many people, to be the focal point of so many concentrating eyes. Perhaps this was enough to make one different, enough to transform one into something else, someone else. Just as by becoming an increasingly larger boy, one became one day a man with a deep voice, although my voice had been deep since I was 12. But what if someone from the campus wandered into the audience, or someone from Mary's, even Mary herself? No, it wouldn't change it. I heard myself say softly. That's all past. My name was different. I was under orders. Even if I met Mary on the street, I'd have to pass her by unrecognized. A depressing thought. And I got up abruptly and went out of the dressing room and into the alley. Without my overcoat, it was cold. A feeble light burned above the entrance, sparkling the snow. I crossed the alley to the dark side, stopping near a fence that smelled of carbolic acid, which, as I looked back across the alley, caused me to remember a great abandoned hole that had been the site of a sports arena that had burned before my birth. All that was left, a cliff drop of some 40 feet below the heat-buckled walk, was the shell of concrete with weirdly bent and rusted rods that had been its basement. The hole was used for dumping, and after a rain it stank with stagnant water. And now, in my mind, I stood upon the walk looking out across the hole, past a Hooverville shanty of packing cases and bent tin signs, to a railroad yard that lay beyond. Dark, depthless water lay without motion in the hole. And past the Hooverville, a switch engine idled upon the shining rails, and as a plume of white steam curled slowly from its funnel, I saw a man come out of the shanty and start up the path which led to the walk above, stooped and dark and sprouting rags from his shoes, hat and sleeves. He shuffled slowly toward me, bringing a threatening cloud of carbolic acid. It was a syphilitic who lived alone in the shanty between the hole and the railroad yard, coming up to the street only to beg money for food and disinfectant with which to soak his rags. Then in my mind I saw him stretching out a hand from which the fingers had been eaten away, and I ran back to the dark and the cold and the present. I shivered, looking toward the street, where up the alley through the tunneling dark, three mounted policemen loomed beneath the circular snow-sparkling beam of the street lamp, grasping their horses by their bridles. The heads of both men and animals bent close as though plotting, the leather of saddles and leggings shining. Three white men and three black horses. Then a car passed and they showed in full relief, their shadows flying like dreams across the sparkle of snow and darkness. And as I turned to leave, one of the horses violently tossed its head and I saw the gauntleted fist yanked down. Then there was a wild neigh, and the horse plunged off in the dark. The crisp, frantic clanking of metal and the stomping of hooves followed me to the door. Perhaps this was something for Brother Jack to know. But inside, they were still in a huddle, and I went back and sat on the bench. I watched them, feeling very young and inexperienced, and yet strangely old with an oldness that watched and waited quietly within me. Outside, the audience had begun to drone, a distant churning sound that brought back some of the terror of the eviction. My mind flowed. There was a child standing in rompers outside a chicken wire fence, looking in upon a huge black-and-white dog, log-chained to an apple tree. It was Master, the bulldog, and I was the child who was afraid to touch him, although, panting with heat, he seemed to grin back at me like a fat, good-natured man, the saliva roping silvery from his jowls. And as the voices of the crowd churned and mounted and became an impatient splatter of hand-claps, I thought of Master's low, hoarse growl. He had barked the same note when angry or when being brought his dinner, when lazily snapping flies or when tearing an intruder to shreds. I liked but didn't trust old Master. I wanted to please, but did not trust the crowd. Then I looked at Brother Jack and grinned. That was it, in some ways. He was like a toy bull terrier. But now the roar and clapping of hands became a song, and I saw Brother Jack break off and bounce to the door. "Okay, brothers," he said. "That's our signal." We went in a bunch, out of the dressing room and down a dim passage, a roar with a distant sound. Then it was brighter, and I could see a spotlight blazing the smoky haze. We moved silently, Brother Jack following two very black Negroes and two white men who led the procession. And now the roar of the crowd seemed to rise above us, flaring louder. I noticed the others falling into columns of four, and I was alone in the rear, like the pivot of a drill team. Ahead,